all of our tension comes from that. Comes from these busy and anxious, worrying thoughts. So try to let go of or put aside all other thoughts for now, and try to just let your mind be in the present moment and present place, right here, right now. And that's actually not so easy to do. However, being aware of our breath helps to do that, because our breath is happening right here, right now. It's not in the past, it's not in the future, it's in the present moment, and it's right here, where we are, where our body is. So with your mind, your awareness, just be aware of your breathing. The breath coming in, and the breath going out, and there's probably a short pause in between the breath coming in and going out, and one breath and the next one. So that's normal, but continue to be aware during that pause. Try not to let your mind run away again. Continue to let your mind be right here, right now, with your body, with your breathing. Try to just stay with the full inhalation of the breath, the pause, then the full exhalation of the breath, and then the pause, and then the next breath. So try to do that for one breath after another. And if a thought pops up in your mind and you notice your mind has gone away from the breath to that thought, as soon as you realize that has happened, gently disengage your mind from the other thought. Put it aside for now. You can always think it later if you need to, but just for now, put it aside and come back to the breath. And if you find it hard to stay focused on the breath, one thing that can help is just saying to yourself, breathing in, breathing out, and then count. One, and then next, breathing in, breathing out, two, and so on. Count up to five, and then start again at one. If you're more experienced, you can count up to 10. If you're new to meditation, just try to do this for 5 breaths in rounds of 5 breaths. So by doing this practice of watching the breath, you might find that our mind calms down. And this calm state of mind is neutral. It's not negative or non-virtuous, but it's also not really positive or virtuous. It's just neutral. So in our tradition, it's said that when we engage in spiritual study, practice, it's good to try to have a positive or virtuous motivation for why we're doing what we're doing. And this will ensure the greatest possible benefit from what we're doing. Motivation is very, very important. It's the main factor that determines if what we do is positive and leads to happiness and spiritual growth, or negative and leads to unhappiness and problems for ourselves and others. So the lamas say it's really important to try to have a positive motivation for the things that we do. So let's spend a few minutes seeing if we can generate such a positive motivation. First, it's good to try to feel how fortunate we are to be born as human beings. As human beings, we're much better off than other kinds of beings, animals, who have more difficult lives and less intelligent minds, less able to understand things and work on their minds, transform their minds. So generally, human beings have more intelligent minds, and we can do a lot of good things with our minds and with our bodies. And then, among human beings, there's some who are in more fortunate circumstances than others. Some human beings are in really difficult circumstances. For example, even right now, at this moment, people are living in places where there's war going on, and shooting and bombing, and people are living in fear of their lives. And also, our people who are refugees, who escaped from war-torn countries, but they're living in camps where the conditions are quite difficult and uncertain. There are also people living in places plagued by famine. They don't have enough to eat. They suffer from hunger and also worry about their families if they have children. They don't have enough food to feed their children. So that suffering is terrible. So here in Singapore, we don't have these problems. The country is at peace, and most people, if not everybody, have enough to eat. Nobody's starving here. Most people have a place to live, so we have quite comfortable lives. And also here you have the opportunity to learn about spiritual teachings, the spiritual path. And you have the time and the fun. That's why you're here today. Nobody stops you from doing this. So in some countries, people don't have that kind of freedom, or they simply don't have access to such teachings. We have many good conditions in our life. And also in our mind, we have the interest in learning spiritual teachings and putting them into practice. But you didn't have to come here today. You could have gone to a shopping mall or some other activity. So the fact that you made the effort to come here today shows that you have the interest in learning these teachings and practicing them. So In Buddhism, we call this a precious human life. This is a human life with all the most ideal conditions and circumstances, both outer and inner, to be able to start practicing the spiritual teaching, the spiritual path, what we call Dharma. Start working on our mind, making our mind more positive, less negative. Bring your mind closer to nirvana and enlightenment. And using our mind and our life in ways that are really beneficial for ourselves and others. So try to feel how fortunate you are. Feel a sense of gratitude and appreciation for this life that you have, for the opportunities that you have. And then try to feel the wish to use your life in ways that are positive and meaningful and beneficial, both for yourself and for others. So if you know about enlightenment, Buddhahood, and are comfortable with that idea, and feel that that's what you would like to work towards, then you can bring that into your mind. You can think, I'm here so that I can learn more about the path to enlightenment, so that I can eventually become enlightened and benefit all living beings. But if you're not so familiar or comfortable with the idea of reaching enlightenment, that may seem too far away. I'm not sure there even is such a thing. That's okay. You could still have some kind of altruistic attitude about being here today. I'm sure we all, at least sometimes, feel that we would like to help others and help the world make the world a better place, more peaceful, more happy, less confused and suffering. So you could bring that thought into your mind and think that you're here to learn ways in which you can make your life more beneficial, not just for yourself, but also for others, for family, friends, neighbors, colleagues, and as many other people and beings as possible. So you could just say to yourself something like, may I learn something here today that will benefit me and others? A while to warm up. It is on. Sometimes it just takes a few minutes to wake up and start working. Just like us, when we wake up in the morning, it takes a while to sort of come out of sleep. People over here, if you want to see this, you don't have to see the screen, but if you want to, there's space over here. So this weekend, I was asked to talk about this topic of mind training, and the Tibetan term for this is lojong. It's kind of a well-known subject. There's been a lot of books printed, published about this topic, and just in particular, I don't know if you've heard of her, but there's an American Buddhist nun named Pema Chodron, who's quite well known in the West anyway. She's very, very popular. And she talks a lot about this kind of practice, and many of her books are about it as well. So she's kind of made it famous in the West. So this topic, mind training or Lojong, just in case some of you are not so familiar with Buddhism in general, just to briefly explain mind, when we talk about mind in Buddhism, because there are many different ideas about mind, what it is. And some people, especially in the West, think that the mind is equivalent to the brain. So when you talk about mind, they immediately think about this physical organ inside of our head. But according to Buddhism, mind is not the brain, and it's actually not physical at all. It's totally non-physical, which makes it a little hard to understand, because most of the things that we see and touch and deal with in our lives are physical things, material things, like our bodies and all the material things in the world around us, buildings and cars and tables and chairs and so on. So these are all physical things. They're made of, you know, physical material, down to molecules, atoms, atomic particles, and so on. So the mind, according to Buddhism, is not physical, not material. It's not made of molecules, atoms, subatomic particles. So that it has no physical properties at all. That means it cannot be seen. We can't see it. Even with the finest instruments scientists have created so far, they're not able to detect the mind. And so we can't see it, we can't feel it, we can't sort of take it apart, put it under a microscope, examine it in any of those ways. Okay? So that's why, you know, many people deny that such a thing even exists, because they say, well, we don't see it. Where is it? So there's a big, you know, it's sort of a controversial topic. Is there such a thing as a non-material, non-physical mind? So Buddhism says yes. The Buddha said yes. And we can know the mind. It's not that we can't know it. We can know it by using the mind itself. This is actually one of the things we do in meditation. Meditation involves using the mind to observe the mind, to watch the mind, to understand the mind, and to transform the mind. Yeah? Well, that's actually the whole idea of Buddhism. The essence of Buddhism is using our mind to work on our mind and transform our mind. Transforming here means making it more and more and more positive, peaceful, pure, beneficial, and less negative, harmful, destructive, miserable, and so on. So gradually we can change our mind, transform our mind by using the mind, not by using, you know, any kind of physical means like diet, okay? I mean, the kind of food we eat, of course, or other substances that we may take, drugs and alcohol and so on, these will have an effect on our mind, but that effect is only temporary, only short-term. So if we want to bring about long-term changes in our mind, we cannot do that by ingesting certain types of foods or substances. And then with, you know, I don't know if this is here in Singapore, but in the West it's very popular to go to the gym. And, you know, people go to the gym and they do bodybuilding, you know, to build up big muscles and make themselves strong and healthy. And that's good for the body, good for your health, good for your long life, and so on. But just by working on our body, It may have some effect on our mind because it's found that exercise, doing physical exercise, does make you happier. I think it's called endorphins, the happy hormone. It's a kind of hormone that's released when we're doing physical exercise. So doing exercise, going to the gym or doing jogging or yoga or whatever, will have an effect on the mind. But again, it's only short term. It's not long term. Because, after 1 hour or a few hours or the next day, some problem may happen and you again become unhappy, angry, depressed, whatever. So it's only short-term benefit that can come from working on the physical level, diet, exercise, and so forth. So in Buddhism, we're concerned about a more long-term change of our mind, and that can only come about by using the mind itself. So that's actually the whole point of mind training. We're trying to change our mind by using our mind. Changing it in a positive way, trying to cultivate more positive states of mind, such as love, kindness, compassion, joy, equanimity, patience. So there's all these positive states of mind. And if we can have more of those more often, we'll be happier. We will be happier, and also we'll make others happier too, because people like to be treated with kindness, not with anger. So when we can have more positive states in our mind, then we have a chance of influencing others and helping them to be more happy and well. So we work on increasing the positive states of mind and decreasing the negative ones, like anger, hatred, and so forth. So that's the idea of mind training. It's also sometimes called thought transformation. That's some teachers or translators use that term, thought transformation. So if you come across that term, it's the same thing. Just depends on which English words you choose. But the Tibetan term lo means mind. It's actually one of many terms for mind. And in Buddhism, there are many different words for mind. So one of them is lo. And then jong is training the mind. So before we get into this topic, I just want to give some more kind of background material, especially if some of you are new to Buddhism. But if you're not new, if you've heard all this before, try not to go to sleep. Try to see it as review, remembering, reminding ourselves. So actually last weekend I was meant to give an introduction to Tibetan Buddhism. So I started talking about this topic but then didn't finish. So just briefly, I just feel a little uncomfortable that I didn't finish. So I'd like to just briefly go over this again. So in our tradition, especially the Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, but I think you find something similar in all the traditions of Tibetan Buddhism. So we have something called the Lamrim. I know many of you have studied that. I've done courses here on Lamrim. Lam means path, and rim means stages. So Lamrim means stages of the path. So it means, what stages we have to go through on the path to enlightenment. The goal that we're trying to reach is enlightenment or Buddhahood, and that's not something we just achieve in one moment, like from one moment to the next. You can't just instantly become Buddha, become enlightened, but it's a gradual process, a gradual transformation, just like if you're taking a journey someplace, overland, if you're going overland, maybe you're going through the Gobi Desert or the Sahara Desert or something, so your journey will have many stages, okay, that may take a number of days or weeks or whatever, okay, so Here we have the stages of the path to enlightenment. And it's a big topic. If you really go into it, you could study it for years to learn all the different details of the Lam Rim. But it can also be condensed in a compact way into what are called these three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment. These are the three main points we need to learn about, meditate on, and work on. It's not just for intellectual knowledge, but they're to be practiced, to be meditated on, so that we actually change ourselves. So the first of the three is called the determination to be free, or renunciation. The term renunciation can be a little off-putting because it sounds like you have to just give up all your fun and sleep on the floor and just eat rice all the time. some people may feel, ooh, I don't want to do that. But that's not the meaning, actually. That's not the meaning of renunciation. What it is we are renouncing isn't pleasure and fun and nice food and so on, but rather it's certain states of mind, certain attitudes in our mind, especially attachment, greed, craving. Okay, the Buddha said that's one of the main causes of suffering. And we're stuck with it. We're kind of addicted to it. So it really drives us, it drives our lives. And some people even think, you can't live without it. Yeah. If you don't have attachment, how can you be happy? So sometimes it's hard to see that attachment actually leads to suffering rather than happiness. But I think, we've all had experiences like that. If you were attached to a certain person, you just got totally obsessed with the person, and you want that person to be your boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever, and have a relationship with them. Or it could be something else, like a certain type of car, or a certain type of computer, or a certain type of TV, or whatever, some material object, or a certain amount of money. You want to have $1 million, okay? Sometimes we have this huge, strong attachment, craving, desire, and even become obsessed with it and feel, I have to have that. I can't be happy if I don't have that. And this one Indian master named Shantideva, he's not around nowadays, but he lived 1,000 years ago, way in the past. But he wrote a wonderful book, text, called The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. I don't know if you've had it. You probably had a chance to study that here. It's a beautiful book. And in there he says something, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact words, but he says, desire never leads to happiness. Because if you have a desire for something, then there's two possibilities. Either you get what you want or you don't get what you want. Right? And if you don't get what you want, then of course that's miserable. If you have a strong desire or craving for something, and you try so hard to get it, but then you don't. You try to get that person to be in love with you as much as you are with them, but you don't feel that way. Or you really try hard to get that particular job or that car or whatever, but you just can't make it. So if you don't get what you want, then of course you're miserable. You're so unhappy. But then he said that even if you do get what you want, you will still suffer. And you probably all had some experience of that, right? Getting that relationship, getting that object. And maybe for a while you're happy, but then later on the happiness may fade and it may even turn into misery. That car is so expensive to maintain and repair and worry about and so on and so forth. So, and just to share this story, I love telling this, this man in America who lives in a town near the sea. And in that town, many people wanted to have a boat, a sailboat, so they could go off and sail in the water, which, of course, is a very pleasant activity to do. They said they have a saying in that town that the two happiest days of your life are the day you buy your boat and the day you sell your boat. So that's an illustration of this, you know. We can sometimes have such strong desire for a certain object or a certain person. But then after a while, even if we get it, we find out, wow, it's not that great. And there's a lot of problems. So that's what Shantideva was saying, you know? If you have desire for something, it will lead to suffering. If you don't get what you want, you will suffer. Even if you do get what you want, you will suffer. So the idea is not to give up on things and our relationships and so on, but to try to work on that attitude, that mind of attachment, of grasping, craving, you know, never being satisfied with what we have and always wanting more and more and better and better. So that's the thing we're trying to renounce. That's the meaning of renunciation. Renouncing that kind of attitude plus other unhelpful, disturbing states of mind like anger, hatred, ignorance, confusion. So the Buddha pointed out a whole bunch of different states of mind. They're called klesha in Pali language. I like to use the word delusion. Deluded states of mind or disturbing states of mind. So we have these within us. And they are the cause of suffering, the main cause of suffering. As long as they are in our mind and we don't know how to manage them, control them, but if they control us, we are controlled by our desire, by our anger, by our confusion. Then we're in a state of suffering, misery. So that's what it is we're trying to renounce or be free of or get rid of, these states of mind. So anyway, that's the meaning of determination to be free. It means determination to be free of suffering. I want to free myself from suffering and the causes of suffering. And the way to do that is primarily by working on our mind and our attitudes, our disturbing emotions. And this is a gradual thing. We can learn how to manage them so they're not in control of us, so we can decrease them. And then eventually it's possible to get rid of them altogether. This is something the Buddha did. Many others have done it as well by following his teachings. It is possible to be completely free of attachment and anger and ignorance and jealousy and pride, all these disturbing emotions. It does take time, so don't expect, you know, this weekend you're going to go home and you're not going to get angry anymore and just going to be calm and peaceful all the time. So it takes time. But it does work. And as you go along, you know, even before you're totally free of these disturbing emotions, they do decrease. So things get better as you go along. I can say that with confidence. Okay, so that's the general idea of renunciation. There's a lot of details to go into, but I won't do that because that's not the main purpose of our weekend. Just one last thing. I think, and a few other fellow teachers, for example, Venerable Thupten Shudran, who's coming next month, we think that another way of talking about this state of mind is self-compassion. Because now in the West, this is quite a popular topic, self-compassion. Because a lot of Western people, and not just Western, other countries, other cultures as well, a lot of people have this problem of self-hatred. You know, we tend to hate ourselves, criticize ourselves, be hard on ourselves, beat ourselves up. Okay, so traditional Buddhism doesn't talk about that. Maybe because, well, I know in the Tibetan tradition, one time there was a meeting between the Dalai Lama and some Western teachers, psychologists, and so forth, and they were talking about teaching Buddhism in the West. And one of the teachers, one of the American teachers, spoke about how when we do loving kindness meditation, metta meditation, usually it's explained in terms of others. You know, may others be happy, may all beings be happy, and so on. But she says when we do this in the West, we have to tell people to feel this for themselves as well. You know, may I be happy, may I be free of suffering, and so on. Because there's so many people who don't have loving kindness for themselves and even hate themselves. So the Dalai Lama was listening to this, and he knows English very well, but he was like puzzled. What's she talking about? So his translator had to, you know, explain to him in Tibetan for a while, and then finally he understood, and he was like astonished. He said, "You mean there are people who hate themselves?" Like, he'd never heard of that before. And then he asked the people in the room, there were, I don't know, 100 or so people. He said, "How many of you have this problem?" And almost everybody put up their hand. And these are professional people, you know, teachers and psychologists and doctors and so on. So that was back in the 90s. Now he's quite aware that this is a problem. And when he teaches, he does address it. And he says, we have to have compassion for ourselves. We have to have loving kindness for ourselves. If we don't, then we won't have it for others. We can't love others if we don't love ourselves. So he and many other Buddhist teachers do talk about this. But when you look at the very traditional teachings of, you know, from Tibet and India in the past, they don't mention this at all. But maybe they didn't have a problem with it. Maybe they didn't hate themselves. So nowadays, it's quite a common problem. So we do need to look out for it. We need to watch our mind and try to notice if we do have this kind of self-hating, self-criticizing, self-judging attitude. And if we do, understand that it's not helpful. Hating yourself is bad just as hating others, right? Hatred is hatred. Anger is anger, whether it's towards yourself or others. So that's definitely an unwholesome, unhelpful attitude that needs to be overcome. So then, you know, I was thinking about how, well, you don't really find talk about self-compassion in the traditional teachings. But then it occurred to me that this is actually self-compassion, because renunciation or determination to be free means determining that I will be free of suffering. I want to free myself from suffering. And that's the meaning of compassion, right? Compassion is described as the wish to be free of suffering. And when you feel compassion for others, you want them to be free of suffering. So naturally, you know, we should also wish ourselves to be free of suffering. That's self-compassion. And that's exactly what this is. The renunciation, the determination to be free. It's wishing to free oneself from suffering, all the different types of suffering and all the causes of suffering, and reach a state of peace, happiness, freedom from suffering. It's wishing that for oneself. So that's self-compassion. So even if the term self-compassion isn't normally used, but I think that's what it is. And I've talked about this with Venerable Children, Thupten Children, and she's of the same opinion. So that means that self-compassion does exist in the teachings, just under another name. Okay, because it's also said that this first of the three principal aspects of the path has to be developed first before the second one. I mean, at least you have to start working on it. It's a basis for the second one. The second one, number two, is bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. This is where you wish to help all living beings, you wish to free all beings from suffering, help them all achieve happiness, and you decide, okay, the way to do that is to become enlightened, to bring myself to enlightenment so I can help all living beings to be free of suffering. So they say if you haven't yet develop the wish to free yourself from suffering, how can you develop the wish to free others from suffering? Right? So they say the first one, number one, is necessary as a basis for number two. So we have to first see how we are in an imperfect situation. We have suffering, we have problems, we have these disturbing emotions in our mind, and this is terrible. And we don't want to be in this situation. We want to get ourselves out of this situation. We want to be free from this situation. We want to reach nirvana, peace. Okay, so we have to feel that way about ourselves. Then we can extend that to others. We look at others and see, oh, well, they are suffering too. They have problems too. They have confusion and greed and hatred and, you know, all these other factors as well. I want them to be free of suffering too. I'm going to help them, not just me. Okay, so it's like you develop this compassion for yourself, wish to free yourself from suffering, and then you open up and extend that to everybody else. So that's the second. And for the second of the three principal aspects of the path, the next slide will go into that. And then the third one, just to briefly mention the correct view of emptiness, we'll get to that because I'm also supposed to explain this little text, which is called the 8 verses of mind training. And the 8th verse, the last verse of that, that does deal with this topic of emptiness. So I'll cover that then, if we get to it. We don't run out of time first. So now I'd like to talk about the second of the three principal aspects of the path in more detail, cultivating bodhicitta. Because bodhicitta is actually the framework for understanding mind training, lojong. Lojong traditionally comes under this topic of bodhicitta. So bodhicitta is a Sanskrit word. Bodhi means enlightenment or awakening, and citta means mind. It's another word for mind, one of many words. You know, they say, I've heard this in America, they say the Eskimos, you know, the Eskimos who live way up in the far north of North America, they have like 20 different words for snow. It's a little bit like that with the Buddhists. We have like 20 different words for mind. I don't know, I haven't counted them. But anyway, different words for mind. Because, you know, mind and understanding the mind, studying the mind and so on is such an important part of Buddhism. Okay, so bodhicitta literally means the mind of enlightenment. But what it means is the wish, the attitude, the state of mind that wants to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. Okay, so it's a state of mind that thinks there's, you know, I want to help all sentient beings. I want them all to be free of suffering and to be happy, and I want to help them do that. I want to, you know, bring that about myself. And how can I do that realistically is to bring myself to enlightenment or Buddhahood first. So it's quite a high state of mind, but we can at least start, even now, even if enlightenment is, you know, far away, we can at least start thinking in that way. Yeah, one day I want to become just like the Buddha so that I can help others. So there's different ways we can cultivate bodhicitta. And one of these ways involves 5 steps. It's called the method of equalizing and exchanging self and others. So there are these 5 different points that you meditate on. So I thought just to explain it, and then we could do a little bit of meditation on it to see how it can help. So the first point is called the equality of self and others. So, you know, in the world we talk about human rights, equal rights. So this is already kind of an idea in democratic countries anyway, you know, that all human beings are equal. All human beings should have equal opportunities, you know, for basic needs, food, clothing, shelter, access to doctors and medical care, and opportunities to work and so on. So this is kind of a normal idea in the world, at least in democratic countries, equality. But here, because what we're talking about here is generating this wish to become enlightened to help all living beings, So it said that one of the main obstacles or hindrances to developing bodhicitta is what's called the self-cherishing attitude or self-centeredness or selfishness. So this is an attitude we all have. You know, it's universal. Where we feel, I am more important than others. Don't worry, it's normal. Something everybody has. So we, even though we are equal, all beings are equal, all human beings and all living beings are actually equal. We all want to be happy. We all want to be free of suffering. We all have the right to be happy and free of suffering. Yet, in our attitude, we tend to favor ourselves. We tend to feel, I am more important than others. So even though this is a normal attitude, but if you want to reach enlightenment, if you want to follow this path to enlightenment, that attitude is a hindrance. That attitude is an obstacle, something we need to work on. We can't immediately get rid of it, but we can gradually reduce it. Eventually, we can be free of it. But in the beginning, we just work on reducing it. So this point is one meditation that helps to start working on that attitude. So there's different ways you can meditate on this. One is simply to contemplate how, just like me, everybody else wants to be happy. And just like me, everybody else doesn't want to suffer. So we are all the same. We are all equal in certain ways. And actually, this contemplation is very helpful just in a practical way, in a daily life way, because we probably find that, you know, there's certain people that we are attracted to and we find them easy to like, easy to be with, you know, when we're in a group or whatever, you know, we have good feelings towards them. But then there are other people that we feel uncomfortable about, you know, we feel like we want to keep distant from, we might feel afraid of them, we might even feel aversion, you know, dislike, disgust, kind of very negative feelings, right? So that's kind of unpleasant to have such an attitude, especially in a place like Singapore. There's so many people here. Right? You really have to make an effort to get away from people. Go in your house, your room, and lock your door. But when you go outside, there's so many people everywhere. So, you know, every day we are meeting with, mingling with, interacting with other people. And also at work, you know, when you're at work, if you work in an office or a factory or whatever, there's lots of other people around. When you're traveling to work on the bus or train or even in the car on the freeway, you know, there's always a lot of other people around. So if we have these attitudes of strong liking for some and disliking, aversion for others, then it can create a lot of unhappiness and tension in our mind, because we can't always avoid the people we don't like. Sometimes they're sitting right next to you on the train or in the office, or they might even be in your family. Okay, so it's helpful to work on this attitude of, you know, like I say, one way of doing this is just to contemplate, just like me, that's another person, another being, another human being. And inside their mind, inside their heart, they just want to be happy like me. That's, you know, they want to be happy like I do. They don't want to suffer like I do. So by contemplating that, getting familiar with that, then you don't feel such a gap, such a distance from the other person. You might still feel annoyed by them or not wanting to get too close to them, but it does make your mind softer and more open and more willing to, you know, treat that person with kindness. Does that make sense, what I'm saying? Yeah. I mean, this is what I have found. It really does help to break down prejudice or fear or aversion or dislike towards other people. Yeah, which is so unpleasant, so uncomfortable, right? When you have those kind of feelings in your mind, it's really unpleasant. So So to be able to have a more open mind, a more open heart towards others. Also, what I find sometimes is, you know, sometimes when I first see somebody or meet somebody, I'll have this initial feeling of aversion. You know, something about them I don't like, you know. But then, you know, sometimes a person might come and talk to me, or I go and talk to them or whatever. And then I discover something, oh, they're actually quite nice, we have things in common. And then I can even feel really open and warm towards them. So this initial feeling that we sometimes have may be totally wrong, you know, totally invalid. We just don't know the person. We're just reacting to how they look, how they dress, how they talk, and so on. But if we get to know that person, then we might even become friends with them. So making ourselves familiar with this idea that we are all equal in certain ways. We're different, of course. This is not to deny the differences. Each person is totally unique. There's no two people who are exactly the same. We know that from fingerprints and DNA and so on. So we are definitely different from each other. But if we focus too much on the differences and not enough on the samenesses, the ways that we are the same, then this is what can lead to, you know, uncomfortable feelings. Also loneliness. We were talking about this the other night. Loneliness is a big problem. Doris sent me that. The UK even has a minister for loneliness. Is that right? Yeah, it's such a huge problem. Huge problem. And it's been found to be linked to illness and shortage of life. Okay, so it's actually bad for your health to be too lonely. And this is one of the causes of loneliness. If we focus too much on the ways in which I am unique and different from everybody else, and we let ourselves be affected by our feelings of dislike and aversion for others, we may eventually find ourselves all alone. I don't want to be with people. They're so annoying. They're so difficult. They're so troublesome. I'll just stay by myself. And Doris also sent me this. There's this guy in Japan who married a hologramic singing star, right? Now that's pretty interesting. And they also have pets, don't they? Mechanical pets, yeah. Anyway, yeah, so I don't know the reasons or the causes for that, but this is one thing that can happen. You just don't want to have anything to do with other human beings. Okay, mechanical pets or hologram, what do they call it? Hologram wife. Yeah, I also, when I was in Denmark a couple of years ago, I saw in a magazine an article about dolls. They make these life-size dolls. Have you heard about that? I was amazed, yeah? So these men would have, you know, dolls, female, you know, attractive female dolls, life-size, and that would be their partner, their companion. You know, so, I mean, I can understand, yeah, if you've been hurt, if you had a really bad relationship and, you know, you're afraid to get into another relationship. Well, a doll isn't going to hurt you. So a hologramic wife isn't going to hurt you the way a human being can. But still, it's sad. It's sad that people get to that point where they have trouble getting along with other human beings. So I think this meditation can help us to avoid that kind of problem and be closer to others and then not have the suffering of loneliness. So anyway, we'll do a meditation on it afterwards, but the point is that we are all basically the same in some ways, even though we are different, but there are things we have in common. We want to be happy, we don't want to suffer. Also, Buddhism says another thing we have in common is that we all have the potential for awakening, for enlightenment. Everyone, every living being has within their mind, within their heart, what we call Buddha nature. That means a pure, true nature of our mind, of our being. And we can tap into that and develop that, bring that out, and one day become enlightened. This is possible for everyone. So that's another way in which we are equal. We're all equal in the potential that we have to reach liberation and enlightenment. And then the second point is looking at the disadvantages of self-cherishing. Or actually, the term self-cherishing can be a little bit problematic, because if you say self-cherishing is bad, self-cherishing is a hindrance, something we want to give up, then it can almost sound as if we shouldn't be kind to ourselves, because cherish means to treat with kindness and care and so forth. So if we say, oh, we shouldn't cherish ourselves, that may sound like, well, it's okay to hate yourself and beat yourself up. So that's not the point. The point is not that. The point is if we are self-centered, selfish. I mean, terms like selfishness and self-centeredness are less problematic. So anyway, with this point, we think about how if I'm self-centered, if I focus on me first, I'm the center of the world, center of the universe, does that really bring me happiness? Not a helpful attitude to have. So in the traditional teachings, the self-centered attitude can lead us to create negative karma, killing, right? Killing, stealing. Whenever anybody does something non-virtuous, like killing or stealing, it's usually motivated by self-centeredness. I don't like that person, so I'm going to put them out of existence. Or I want that person's money, so I'm just going to go and take it. Right? So the attitude is, I am more important than the other person. My wishes, my needs are more important than others. So that's one of the big problems of self-centeredness. If we're excessively concerned about me and more about others, then it can motivate us to do harmful things to others. And we may end up in jail, committing a crime. But even if you don't end up in jail, you still have that bad karma. You may escape from the cops, but you can't escape from the karma. Karma follows you. The karmic cops, they will catch up with you eventually. So you'll suffer and have problems due to the karma. So that's one way of thinking about how self-centeredness leads to problems rather than happiness. But we can also just see it in our life, like when we behave selfishly, you know, as opposed to putting others first, caring for others. Does it really bring us happiness? Does it really make us feel good? I heard about a study that was done by Harvard Business School where they asked people various questions. One of the questions was, do you feel better when you give something to yourself or when you give something to another person? And most people responded they feel happier when they give something to another person. So that's something we can see for ourselves. You go shopping and you buy yourself some new whatever, clothes or jewelry or device. Okay, there's a certain amount of happiness, a certain amount of pleasure there. But on the other hand, when you give a gift to another person, something that brings them joy, happiness, it's a different kind of feeling, isn't it? Different kind of happiness. So by that, we all have experiences of that, then I think we can see that being more self-centered is not so ideal, and that is paired with the next point, which is the advantages of altruism. Altruism means caring for others, having kindness, compassion for others, being generous with others, helping others and so on. So when we compare being self-centered, selfish, and being altruistic, caring for others, which is nicer, which feels better, which brings more genuine happiness and peace? So if we contemplate that, we will probably, hopefully, conclude that being altruistic is better than being selfish. And the Dalai Lama sometimes you know, he talks about this a lot, of course, how important it is to be altruistic, compassionate, and kind, and so on. But he says, but, you know, even if you are going to be selfish, at least be wisely selfish. Meaning, you know, if we are selfish in a way that we hurt others, we harm others, right? We don't care about others at all, and we hurt them, we manipulate them, we use them, we control them, and so on. So that's like a really awful way of being selfish. And what's the result of that? Yeah? We suffer, others suffer, and again, we may end up in jail. We create that karma. So that's not very intelligent. That's not very wise. So the point he's trying to make is, if you are selfish, meaning you want to be happy, you want to, you know, make yourself happy and do well in your life, the best way to do that is by helping others. Because if you are kind, helpful, compassionate to others, you will feel happier. There's actually evidence of this. Studies have been done and they in the West, and they find that, the number one beneficiary of compassion is yourself. If you are kind and compassionate to others, you get a lot of benefit. It's good for your health, it's good for your happiness, it's good for your relationships with others. Okay, so there's actually evidence of this. So that's what the Dalai Lama is talking about. If you really want to be happy, you want to take care of yourself, your needs, the best way to do that is by helping others, being altruistic. It doesn't mean you have to give up your own happiness, but this is the best way to be happy. The best way to be happy is to be altruistic. And that's what he means by wise selfishness. The best way to make yourself happy is by caring for others, being kind and compassionate for others. So then the next point, number four, is exchanging self-centeredness for altruism. It's traditionally called exchanging self for others, but that's what it actually means. It means deciding that you're going to change your mind, you're going to work on your mind, your attitudes, and try to be less self-centered and more altruistic, because you can see that that's the best thing to do for everybody. It's the best thing to do for yourself. It's also the best thing to do for others. Okay. So the fourth point is simply just making that decision. I'm going to work on this. We can't change overnight. It takes time to change, but at least to make the effort gradually to be less selfish, more altruistic. And there's lots of methods. This is what we're focusing on this weekend. How to do it. How to be more altruistic. How to be less self-centered. And the fifth point is called taking and giving. Tonglen in Tibetan. Again, Pema Chodron has made this very famous in the West. In her teachings and her books, she talks a lot about Tonglen. Teaches it, so a lot of people know about Tonglen. And the idea of Tonglen, it's a practice you do, a meditative practice. And there's different ways of doing it, very extensive, very simple. The simple way is, well, I'll explain this and then we'll do it together. The idea of taking and giving is with compassion. You feel compassion for another person or a group of people, but you can start with just one person, feeling compassion for another person and feeling, I would like to take away their suffering. I see that they're suffering and I wish them not to suffer, and I would like to take that suffering away from them. That's the idea of taking away the suffering from another person. And in the traditional way of doing this, you take it into yourself. You imagine, you visualize, you're taking that suffering. One way is to imagine it like smoke or fog or cloud, a dark cloud. You imagine breathing that in, and it comes to your heart, in the center of your chest, the heart chakra. There you can think of your self-centered attitude, your ego, your selfishness, all the kind of problematic attitude you have. You imagine them there in some sort of form, like a dark spot, or I like to think of a black hole, because I read, I don't know, there's different views on what a black hole is, but I read that, you know, we have these, there are these black holes in space, and whatever goes into a black hole just disappears. It goes out of existence. So I thought, oh, that's a nice analogy. So I mentioned this black hole here at my heart. Then when that suffering comes in, it goes into that and disappears. It's not that you take on the suffering and then you are suffering. You have that suffering yourself. Not like that. You take it in and you use that suffering to eliminate your ego, your self-centeredness. And they all go out of existence. And then you're left with just this kind of peacefulness, spaciousness. And then you think of all your good energy, your good karma, your good qualities, the good things you have in your life, all the good things about yourself in your life. And you imagine sending those out to others. That's the giving part. Because you think, I would like this person to be happy, to have happiness, to have whatever they need to be happy. I would like to share what I have with them. So imagine all your good stuff going to the other person and bringing them happiness and joy. So that's the basic idea of taking and giving, Tonglen. So you can do it with one person, you can do it with a group of people. The full way of doing it is with all sentient beings. But that's hard, especially in the beginning. So it's good to start with just one person, especially somebody you care about. Okay, so let's do some meditation just to get some more understanding of these points. And if you're feeling uncomfortable because you've already been sitting about an hour and a half and you like to stand up for a moment, stretch your legs so that you can be more comfortable during the meditation. Okay, so for the meditation, try to sit with your back straight. So whether you're in a chair or on the floor, you can have your legs in whatever way is comfortable for you. But do try to sit with a straight back, because that helps your mind to be more clear and awake, alert. But at the same time, try not to be tense. Try not to have tension in your body. Try to have your body as light and relaxed and free of tension as possible. And you can close your eyes if you wish during the meditation, but it can be a little risky closing the eyes because then you might fall asleep. So if you're feeling very tired and you think you might fall asleep, it might be better to keep the eyes open a little bit. And if you have your gaze looking downwards onto your lap or the floor in front of you, then there's just a little bit of light coming in to help you stay awake. But your eyes aren't open so wide that you would see things that would distract you. So try doing that to prevent sleepiness. And then check to see if your mind is here or somewhere else. The past or the future or some other place. And if there are such thoughts in your mind, then put them aside. You can always pick them up again later, but decide that for now you'll keep your mind here in this present moment and present place, focused on this meditation that we're doing. And if during the meditation some thought comes up, or you notice your mind wandering away, then be aware of that, but put aside the other thought and bring your mind, your awareness, back to the meditation. So start by going into your mind or your heart and trying to notice or get in touch with a very basic feeling that we have, a kind of instinctive, intuitive feeling that says, I just want to be happy and I don't want to suffer. It's almost like a little voice deep down inside that says that. I want to be happy. I don't want to be unhappy. I don't want to suffer. And don't feel bad to have such an attitude. It isn't wrong. It's normal. And according to Buddhism, we actually should be happy and shouldn't have to suffer. Suffering happens because of confusion, ignorance, just not knowing the right way to live in order to be happy and avoid suffering. So we have the right to be happy, we have the right to avoid suffering. So it's completely okay to wish for that. But it's also helpful to understand you're not the only one who feels this way. Everyone else does too. So bring to mind some people you know, people you're close to, people you love, care about, your family, close friends. And contemplate that they feel the same way as you. They have within their mind or heart the same wish to be happy and to not be unhappy, to not suffer. Think about some people who are a bit more distant from you, not your inner circle of family and friends, but neighbors, people living next door to or across the street or across the corridor from where you live. People you see when you go in and out of your house or apartment. people at work, people you work with but are not very close to. And contemplate that those people feel the same way as you, in the same way as your family and friends. They are human beings, they have a mind, and within their mind or heart, they also just want happiness, and they don't want to suffer, to be unhappy, to have problems or difficulties. About all the other people here in this room. Some of them you might know and love, care about. Some of them you might not know at all, they're complete strangers. Some you might even find annoying or irritating. But understand that we are all the same, we are all equal in certain ways, like this one. We all share the same wish to be happy and to not suffer, to not be unhappy. Extend this to all the other human beings in the world. Most of them we've never met, and we probably never will. But we can still understand, based on our own experience, that they are human beings, they have a mind, thoughts, feelings, and in their mind is this same feeling or attitude of wanting to be happy, wanting to have good experiences, and not wanting to be unhappy, to have pain, problems, bad experiences. So all the other 7+ billion human beings with whom we share this planet, even though they may have different languages, different ways of dressing, different kinds of foods they eat, different kinds of activities, ideas, thoughts, beliefs. They're different in many ways. This is something we all share, we all have in common. We all just want to be happy and don't want to suffer. And then contemplate also this idea we find in Buddhism that all of us, all human beings, and in fact all living beings who have a mind, we all have Buddha nature, meaning we have the potential to transform our minds and make our minds free of all suffering and causes of suffering, and develop our minds to have all good qualities, positive qualities, happiness, all the way up to enlightenment. So we all have the possibility to transform ourselves, our minds, and bring our minds to the state. state of enlightenment, the state of perfection, Buddhahood. So that's something else we all have in common. Us has the tendency to think I am more important than others. I am number one. I am the center of the universe. So we have the habit to pay more attention to our own needs and wishes. And sometimes this can even lead to behavior that is inconsiderate of others, or manipulative of others, or even harmful of others. See if you can recall an experience like that, where you were really caught up in yourself, your needs, your wishes, and you put yourself first before somebody else, and even behaved in a way that was hurtful for the other person, that caused problems for the other person. I'll try to remember that experience, and what was the result of that? How did you feel? How did the other person feel? Fortunately, we're not like that all the time. And there are other times when we're not so selfish. And we can even be altruistic. We can even think of another person's needs and wishes before our own. This is particularly true in the case of parents. So some of you are parents, you have children. So there's probably many occasions when you put your children before yourself, your children's needs and wishes before your own. Even those of you who are not parents probably have experiences like that, where you put another person's needs and wishes before your own. So try to remember a time like that, an experience like that, where you were really caring for another person, really genuinely altruistic, not so concerned about yourself. And remember that experience and check what was the result. How did you feel? How did the other person feel? So spiritual masters such as the Buddha, but also spiritual teachers of other traditions such as Jesus Christ, usually emphasize how important it is to be loving and kind and compassionate and helpful, generous towards others. We find this theme running through spiritual religious teachings, but also recent research done in the West on these states of mind and compassion find evidence that it does make us feel better. It's better for our health. We have less stress and live longer, and also we're happier. We have a more satisfying life, better relationships with others, and so on. So if we have more of these positive qualities, kindness, compassion, being helpful for others, being generous with others, and so on, that this is actually good for ourselves, and also it's good for others, it's good for the world. There are many, many, many benefits for everyone if we can be more altruistic. So, see if you can recognize this and feel the wish to work on being more altruistic, kind and compassionate and helpful, and to be less egotistical, selfish, self-centered. Do wish to change ourselves and be less selfish, more altruistic. The habit of thinking of ourselves first is pretty strong, pretty long term, not so easy to change. But there's this method, this practice called Tonglen, taking and giving, that can help to bring about this change in our mind. Let's try this practice. So we'll try it by thinking of someone we already care about who is going through some difficulties right now. Could be sick or in pain or unhappy, depressed. So bring to mind someone you know, someone you care about, who's suffering. We have some difficulty right now. And it's helpful if you can have a mental picture of this person. You can imagine them right in front of you, or just think of the person wherever they are right now. And spend a bit of time contemplating the difficulties this person is going through. Try to put yourself in their shoes. Try to understand or empathize with their suffering, their difficulties right now. As you do this, see if you can generate the feeling of compassion. It probably just comes up naturally because you do care about this person and you don't want them to suffer. That's the meaning of compassion, is wishing the person to not suffer, to be free of their suffering. So see if you can let that feeling, that attitude come up in your mind. In case it doesn't come up, you could try saying to yourself words that express that feeling, such as, I wish you to be free of suffering, or how nice it would be if you could be free of your suffering. See if you can go one step further and wish that you could take away their suffering and even take it onto yourself. If you don't feel ready to do that, that's okay. You don't have to push yourself to do it. If you do feel willing to at least try taking away their suffering, and imagine your self-centered attitude and any other problematic states of mind you have, like anger, confusion, greed, and so forth. So all the obstacles you have in your mind, imagine them in the form of something at your heart, like a black spot, or a black hole, or a rock, something kind of heavy and uncomfortable and problematic. And then imagine the other person's suffering, physical or mental or both, coming out of them in the form of smoke or fog or cloud. And as you inhale, imagine you're breathing in that suffering, that cloud of suffering. Imagine it goes to that place in your heart chakra, in your chest, that black hole, and absorbs there and disappears, and also your selfishness, your ego, your problematic states of mind, they too disappear. They all just vanish, go out of existence. Leaving that area in your chest clear and spacious, open, peaceful. All those problematic states of mind have disappeared, as well as this person's suffering, have all vanished. And then think of all the good qualities that you have, your kindness, your intelligence, your good karma from good things you've done, as well as all the good things you have in your life, a good job, home, food, friends, whatever good things there are in you or in your life. Imagine those in the form of something really beautiful, like a star, a jewel, a sun, a bright light there in your heart chakra, your chest. Sparkling, bright, beautiful. And feel how nice if you could share this good energy with the other person and bring them happiness, whatever they need to be happy and satisfied and fulfilled. Imagine light going out from your heart, from this beautiful thing in your heart, going to them, going inside of them, filling them up, and bringing them the happiness they need and long for. Imagine them looking happy, being happy. and see how that affects you, having done this practice. How do you feel? So we have a little bit of time left before we finish for this morning. Do any of you have any questions you would like to ask? I see a hand, yes? Say it in the microphone.
Be a little confused, but I have two questions. First one about self-cherishing, self-hatred. Can self-cherishing coexist with self-hatred?
Can self-cherishing coexist with self-hatred? I think so. Because I think self-hatred, if you have self-hatred, self-criticalness, that kind of tendency, and if you really examine it and try to understand what's going on with that, you'll probably notice there is a lot of selfishness, there's a lot of self-concern. I mean, this is my experience, because I have that problem. So this is what I've discovered about it. Even though it's kind of hating yourself, but there's also like a lot of expectations, you know, like I want to be perfect. I want to be the best. I don't want to make any mistakes. I don't want to make any faults. You know, so it's actually kind of a lot of me involved. You know, almost obsessed with oneself. So I'm just suggesting this to you, you know, that you do that if you have that problem of self-hatred. That you look into that and try to understand what it's all about. And you might find, I'm not saying it's absolutely definite, but you might notice, you might find that there is kind of a lot of self-concern there. So I think it is possible that there could be both self-centeredness, self-concern, and self-hatred at the same time. But that's something for each person to investigate for themselves, to look into their own mind and see if that's the case.
The other part of the question was, is it a strong sense of self that causes this phenomenon? And when you mentioned that the Dalai Lama was surprised in the 90s.
Mentioned what?
When the Dalai Lama was surprised in the 90s that there was this strong sense of self-hatred. I was wondering if there was anything to do with the fact that there is a strong sense of self-identity and this grasping at self. And that doesn't seem to be very much with Tibetans.
Yeah, it does seem to be a cultural thing. Tibetans do seem to be more relaxed and comfortable with themselves, even if, you know, they just don't seem to have that habit of beating themselves up and expecting a lot of themselves. So, and they seem to be generally quite cheerful and easygoing and relaxed and so on. And I also heard from someone who's stayed and studied in a Tibetan monastery for many years, but coming from the West, and this person said, yeah, it does seem that they aren't so competitive and so driven, you know, to achieve high levels of success in their studies and be number one and so on. So they seem to, you know, many of them are content to not even take exams, you know, just study but not bother with taking the exams. And even if they do take exams and they don't do very well, it's not a big problem for them. So, so yeah, they're quite... I'm not saying that's true for everybody. I mean, there may be some among Tibetans who are very kind of competitive and driven in that way, but anyway, that was what this person mentioned. So, what was the question?
So
it could be a cultural thing, yeah, and I think this is my view that, you know, in like I come from America, where we have a very strongly competitive culture and so much emphasis on how you look and how you perform, and so that does have quite an effect on your self-identity. So if you're not so great looking, or you're not so successful academically, or, you know, in your work and so on, then there's often the feeling, oh, I'm a loser, I'm a failure, I'm horrible. So that cultural kind of situation could lead to more self-hatred. But then also the whole Buddhist thing, we'll get into this later, we don't have time now, but, you know, a big part of Buddha's teachings is about the self. What is the self? And, you know, we believe in our self existing in a way that's very exaggerated. You know, we have a sense of a strong, real, concrete I somewhere inside of us. Buddhism says, no, that's not true. The way we think we exist isn't true. It's strongly exaggerated. So Tibetans, because they've had Buddhism in their culture for, I don't know, at least 1,200 years, and it pretty much pervaded all their culture, music, art, and so on and so forth. So, and they grow up into this culture. So I think, you know, qualities like compassion, kindness, unselfishness, selflessness are pretty strong in their culture. So, so that may be one of the factors as well. I'm not so strongly concerned about I, me. So there could be many factors. I don't know all of them, but yeah. Maybe just one more question. We'll break. Moses.
Venerable, I'm wondering if you could say a bit more about altruism, because...
Yeah, altruism. It was toxic. Yeah. Yeah, well, this is another kind of hot topic when it comes to compassion, all these kind of positive qualities like compassion, kindness, generosity, patience, and so forth. These are normally said to be good qualities, positive qualities, but then it's also possible that we engage in those qualities or practice them in ways that are not very wise and skillful. And so, this will come clear later. They need to be balanced with wisdom and skillful means. Because otherwise, yeah, you try to help somebody or be kind to somebody or do good for others and end up getting hurt, and the other person gets hurt and things become a big mess. So compassion and kindness, altruism, do need to be balanced with wisdom and thinking in terms of what is really beneficial, and not just acting in an impulsive way. So that's a big topic, and maybe we'll get into it more later, but right now we have to stop. Thanks for bringing up the question. So if you have other questions, we can take care of them later. But now we we'll stop for lunch. So we have a break now until 1:30. You can go in plenty of places around here to find food. Singapore is full of food places, eating places. So, and then 1:30, there'll be a meditation led by Wai Chong. Wai Chong, I don't know if you don't know him, he's a very experienced teacher and meditation leader. So he'll lead a meditation from 1:30 to 2, and then 2 o'clock I'll come back and continue with the teaching until 4. So we're going to end at 4 today, in case you haven't already heard. Okay, so let's just take a moment to make a dedication of what we've done so far. We've created some good energy by coming together and listening, thinking about, meditating on these teachings about how to transform our mind, make it more positive, less negative. So this has been a really good thing to do. We've created good energy, a merit. So now let's mentally share this merit with others. May it bring happiness, peace, well-being, freedom from suffering to everyone, all beings everywhere, and help us all get closer to enlightenment. Okay, so enjoy your lunch and see you later.